Hey folks, we're here with the .NET Framework team, and guys, why don't you quickly introduce yourself? We'll go left to right here.
Hi, I'm Eric St. John, a dev on the .NET Framework team.
I'm Emil Landroff, I'm a program manager on the .NET Framework team.
And I'm Dave Keane, a dev on the .NET Framework team.
And today's wonderful topic is API reviews. So we're talking about opening up .NET Framework. That means API reviews are now going to be open, right? So it'd be great to kind of get just a quick overview. What do you guys mean when you say API reviews, and kind of what's the process? And then we can dig a lot deeper.
Yeah, so in the last video where we talked about the open source .NET Core, the one thing that I mentioned is that we have a whole bunch of processes that we used to use internally when we shipped on these like 3-year or 4-year release cycles. And if you think about how software development in these environments work, is what you end up having where you have a bunch of feature crews that work on features. And every once in a while, you have these sync points where you know some reviews are happening, right? I mean, obviously, there are spec reviews before. But once you put all these features together, they work as a unit, right? And so one thing that we in the framework always cared about since pretty much day one is, what's the usability of the APIs? Like, what is the kind of code that you have to write when you interact with the APIs, right? And then you know, once you have a few releases out there, you know, Eric's topic is compatibility. So how do you make sure that when you change implementations or you change API shapes, what would happen to the ecosystem, right? When you have a million computers out there, or billion computers in our case, you know, a 0.05 regression is a lot of machines still, right? And so one of the things that our team in particular drove over the years was API reviews. And so the way API reviews work is generally, basically what we think about it is scenario-driven design. So you start basically with sample code, you kind of write the code that you think you will use when you actually interact with the APIs, and then a bunch of experts basically judge what's the flow of the APIs, and then a bunch of other concerns like, you know, does this use existing patterns? Does it reinvent patterns? Or, you know, what's the shape of the APIs? Do we have something similar already out there? What's the naming? Basically, there's a whole bunch of things. In fact, there is so much that Christoph Svalina, a PM on our team, and someone wrote a book about it, right? There's like 350 pages or something. And so there's a lot of stuff to consider. And so on our side, we basically have a board of experts that every once in a while looks over these APIs and then does reviews. And so what we did when we open sourced .NET Core is the very first thing that we had to tackle is, if people add APIs, how are we going to judge them? Do we just let them all in, or do we do the reviews? But the problem with the review model that we used to have is that, first of all, it's on campus. It's, you know, a bunch of, you know, it's a conference room with a bunch of people. But it only really works if it's all on campus, right? We didn't have a model for how do we tackle actually things that are public. And so what we ended up doing is we just recorded one of our meetings, send it online on Channel 9. It got very popular. We got like 65,000 views, I think. And lots of people pinged me on Twitter and said, can you give some more details on what's going on there? Why do you care so much? What are the kind of people that are working on that? And so in this meeting or in this video, I actually want to talk a bit more about what's happening there. And so I brought two of my guys that are actually experts there. So it will be awesome.
Great. So like let's go through an example. Like what's an API review that you all recently went through? Like and I know you had some pulled up on the site as well.
Yeah, so should I stop to the side or how does it or can we just
we'll be able to see the full screen.
Awesome.
So
basically what we have here is we basically have a proposal for adding generic collection interfaces to regex. And so what does it actually mean? Well, somebody basically wrote up a proposal. In this case, it's Justin. Justin's a former PM on our team, so he kind of knows what he's doing there. But he's now working for free on our open source implementation, which is kind of neat.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Justin. And so basically what he did here is he wrote up basically why are we doing, like why I'm proposing this change and what does it mean for code samples. And so this is where you can immediately see what scenario-driven design looks like. So the very first thing is he basically provides a code sample that what you would have write today when you actually want to use link over regex. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty involved because you basically, you know, groups is an old style V1 collection, so it doesn't actually have the type baked into the API surface. And so when you actually do link operations on them, it just knows them all as objects. So the first thing you do is you just cast everything into group because you know there's only group instances in this collection. And then you can actually do like strongly typed operations on them, and then you know, when you actually switch from group to captures again, you get objects back, so you have to cast again to captures, and it's somewhat awkward to work with this API. And so if he basically gets his feature in, then what happens is you can just basically remove all these you know, cast operations, then it becomes very natural, like the API feels like as it should have been. And then he basically just goes into detail in like what does it actually mean for the public API service, and he just provides a dump of you know, what the new API looks like. And that is essentially what we have done internally all along. So like, we obviously have some tools that makes this a bit easier. So we can actually show an API diff between, you know, what do we have today, what would we add, and then we can actually review this. And then Yeah, I think in the meeting, like we actually in the video recording, you can see how we are talking about this, what the trade-offs are. And then after the meeting, we actually publish notes. And so in this particular thing, we actually have a link to the notes for this particular proposal, actually with the link to the video as well, so you can straight jump into the discussion if you want. But there's basically some high-level bullet points of things that came up in the design. And so generally when that happens, when we actually touch an area, like there's always some discussion on some meta points, right? Like why would we do this kind of change, or what is the trade-offs that we consider here? This particular example we talked about, we have this concept of read-only and non-read-only collections in the framework. So what kind of interfaces should we implement moving forward? Because when the framework originally was designed, there was only one kind of collection type, and you would basically implement the interface to indicate by returning a Boolean, are you read-only or not? Mm-hmm. But now we added read-only interfaces, you also added immutable interfaces, so the question is now, do we keep implementing all of them for eternity, or do we do some other thing?
And if you look at the video, if you watch the video, there's actually even a point in contention between the devs in the room. You know,
Inconceivable.
Yes, we don't all agree. On some side, you know, people are thinking that, you know, from now on, if you have collections or read-only collections, that you only implement the read-only collection interfaces. On the other side, the feeling is that you should continue to implement the V1 interfaces just so that interoperability with the rest of the framework works well. And on our side, we're still leaning towards the second case, just for interoperability with existing APIs. Because when you have an interface, design an API that takes a collection interface, you have to make a decision whether you implement read-only one, or you take the mutable one. And given the history of the framework, 15 years of history, you know, most people are still taking the mutable one. So that was one of the points in contention. Other ones that came up was serialization. Yeah.
So when we start thinking about bringing these APIs to existing applications, shipping them as part of the desktop framework, adding new interfaces and causing existing apps to light up on these types is a significant concern. So apps often will try and do a cast and have special behavior, treat collections differently if they implement a particular interface. Most of our serializers do, but often people, when adding interfaces, don't think, oh, I'm adding code, how could it possibly break an application? But in particular, serializers often break when you add a collection interface, because they aren't expecting it, or then when you try and share the serialized bytes with a machine that doesn't have the patch, then things blow up because the types don't agree. So our purpose, we need to highlight that you know, serialization is a concern here, and sometimes we'll mitigate that concern by having adapters or quirking the new code.
So a couple of questions, like, okay, how would you know that serializers are blowing up with, say, a new interface? Like, and this goes to some of the stuff like you
mentioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. So history and experience. Are there ways for somebody to be like, hey, here's my app, don't break it, like register my app, and whatever you do, don't break my app going forward? or how do you get like real world data to know these kind of examples?
So in the end, you just have to test. But a lot of times we'll quirk new API, which means the new API will never be observable through to the app at compile time because of targeting packs and target framework versions. But at runtime, the new API is observable through reflection and other things. So we'll never quirk reflection. Like, doing so is just that if we do that, as I think Dave mentioned before, then we've lost. We can't hide new types at runtime.
But when you say quirk, you mean do something special?
Yeah.
A special case for that example? Like, what's a good example where you've quirked something for compatibility?
Sure. In .NET Framework 4.5.1, we changed the sorting algorithm. What was that? Sorry, 4.5, I misspoke. We changed the low-level sorting algorithm, which still sorted elements in the array, but sorted them in a slightly different behavior given equal elements. And so that impacted a lot of applications. And so as a result, that change was quirked, meaning that only applications that target a new framework version that compile against the new reference assemblies will see the change. Even though apps built against 4.0 or 4.5 can run on the same runtime, only the newer apps will see the new behavior. For a case,
the idea for that is that the devs find it at dev time, not at run, not in production, right?
How would a developer know, like for example, if I'm moving 4.5, 4.5.1, to know like, hey, if I do target that new framework, now I'm going to get this new sorting algorithm? Is this like a release notes kind of thing?
We document all these quirks in our breaking change notices. Ideally, we try and use them sparingly, so there's very few of them. Ideally, we try and make changes that don't have these quirks, because if we do that, it's a concession in a way that we've lost. So really, we rely on quirks only when we know that we have to move forward, that we have to provide new behavior, and we have a commitment to keep those older apps working. So it's really when we make these tough compromises that we use this tool, and then we document it, and we try and make sure that when folks do that, that it's a very clean, easy to understand difference. So we don't use quirks for subtle bug fixes. If we find that a subtle bug fix has compatibility risk, mm-hmm. then we prefer to try and iterate on the bug fix in order to make sure that it's done compatibly or find a place for a cleaner break.
Okay. Yeah, I think in general, like, if you think of quirks, like basically what they do is they provide a mechanism for applications to opt into the new behavior, right? The way quirks work is you opt in by just targeting the later version of the framework, right? But there are other examples where, you know, this is basically implicitly, I just take my existing app, just change the drop-down value, but I didn't even change my app. That's one way to opt in. Another way to opt in is to say there's a separate API that you have to call, and then you get a new behavior. But as Eric mentioned, like sometimes when you have these core things like sorting, right, we don't want to have array.sort and array.sort better, right? That's just mm-hmm. weird. And so at some point you have to make a decision like, okay, either we don't evolve this area at all, or we do it and then we try to stay compatible, but still say at some point, yep, you get the new behavior, and then that's the way you, you have to change your app potentially to do that. But I think, you know, evolution is hard. One thing that open source gets us, and especially like before we did open source, we did these out-of-band releases. As you mentioned, like good data sometimes is rare, right? You don't know upfront will this change impact anybody or not. In many cases, you opt in, you basically like tend towards the extremes, right? Depending on what your experience is on the team. If you're new to the team, you basically say, oh, break everybody, like this is the right design. If you're 10 years on the team, you say, don't touch anything because you will break everybody. And so basically what happens when out-of-band releases happen, we can just put it out. And then if people don't like the new version, they always have an option to just target the older version of the same component.
And we have more time to react, right? With the full framework, when you've gone and put it on Woo and Windows Update and push it out to the world, it's very hard to react to breaks in those mm-hmm. cases. With NuGet packages and app local deployment, where the app carries the new version with it, it's very easy to react to those things because there's varying adoption's slower, and they've got an option to roll back to the previous version.
Yeah, and we still have the intent to make all these changes compatible, but the NuGet packages do give us that ability to react to it, to act in lieu of the data that we can't possibly have. So to make a change where we say this might be risky, it might not. I don't know. I can't test every app in the world. Put it out in a limited release and catch it. And then to bring it back to the review, a lot of times the things that ultimately we still want to catch as many compatibility problems up front as we can, because it's expensive to do a release and to catch it in the wild, even in the NuGet package case, because there will be some delay in turnaround. And so we just know that there's a lot of things that people often forget, and we want it. We try and have people who have experienced it enough to bring those things up and to make sure that folks test it. In the particular serialization case, we can't quirk that, but it's one of the things that people often forget. And the mitigation is usually just some markup on your type in order to work with the serializer and tell it about the change you've made, or potentially to implement a custom serialization interface so that you can preserve the old behavior. So that's what we tried to do in this case, and that's the value that the compatibility part of the review in FXDC brings in.
So when a customer like wants to have some, let's say a new API, do they say, hey, really I want this to be kind of .NET framework core, for lack of a better word, versus full framework? would you all just look at one versus the other? Like, hey, we don't think this, like, I'm not targeting for you all to break this, but we think this is an area for innovation? Or do you have to look at the whole no matter what, thinking that, hey, we're going to bring this back no matter what, so any change kind of has to be compatible?
Yeah, I guess that's something that we still try to figure out what our bar is. I mean, and generally, like, the way we think about .NET Core is today it's designed to be a subset of framework 4.6, the next version of the framework, right? But the problem is .NET Core revs faster because it's open source. So once 4.6 is released, obviously there will be points in time when .NET Core is no longer a subset because we added an API, right? So the long-term intent is absolutely to get these changes back into the full framework. But then, as Eric pointed out, sometimes you have these complicated interfering designs, and then you have to figure out what's going on, right? You have to basically make a decision whether you, you know, don't port the API or you do something in the implementation to make it more compatible.
All right, so Christoph just joined us. This is a great pleasure. So Christoph, you want to quickly introduce yourself?
I'm Christoph Swalina. I work on the core.
My title is developer manager, but I don't manage anybody. I used to manage some people, but a few months ago. They haven't changed my title. I don't know what the problem is. Maybe they want me to like have some cool title.
Would be a breaking change to change the
Would
title.
Would be a breaking
change. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we're just talking about customers submitting pull requests. How do they target, for example, core versus full framework and some of the process? So one of the interesting parts is, like, if we were internal, like inside Microsoft, we'd do this API review, there'd be feedback, and like you'd probably set up another meeting. Like, how do you make it so, like, is it a weekly process for API reviews? And then how do you handle it when there's feedback? You want the customer to respond, and then you have to respond on their response, and like this process where you do multiple things. Because when it's internal, like, you can almost close this via email, right? Like, oh, I'll make the change. Here's the pull request. Go.
I think generally, like, it's not like some of the process is the same when we do it externally, right? I mean, the way I think about this, internally we have basically a regular meeting where the experts meet, and then they review basically whatever is latest in the backlog, right? And we'll do the same with GitHub. So we started tagging all the pull requests and issues, which are proposals for APIs, in a certain way, and that creates a backlog. So basically, when we meet, we just literally walk the backlog, which is what we did in the last video recording, as you can see. And then we basically send a bunch of notes. The notes are also public. They're in a separate GitHub repository where we can actually upload, you know, the API diffs plus the notes that we took. And then we just, on the PR, we just send people to the notes and says, we just reviewed the API, here are the notes. And then if the feedback is trivial, like, I would expect the resolution over email, what we do internally, is just resolution over GitHub comments on the PR, right? We just say, oh, maybe you should do this. The guy who proposed it says, okay, I did this instead, is this still okay? And we say, looks good, fine. And then it will go in, right? It's the same process.
So for some of these PRs, like, because this one seemed like it was more like almost the interface mm-hmm. of how you would call it, regardless of the actual implementation. Do you see the pull request still having to do the implementation? It's not like, hey, great contract and we'll do the work. Or is it like, hey, customer, go look at our maybe existing regex or existing collection class and do the implementation? Or are there any examples where you do one or the other? Or
yeah, I think in general the idea of API reviews or, you know, break and change reviews is the idea is you step back, right? If I look at the actual code review, the actual code change, then it's very easy to get hung up on, oh, you didn't format this correctly, or maybe you should add a comment over here. And when you actually step back, you look at the bigger picture, which is essentially what API diffs give you, then you catch the broader interaction points. But there are still cases, you pointed out, where, in a good example, I think we put it in the notes, is if you implement the non-read-only interfaces, the question is, what exceptions should you throw if somebody calls a mutating API? Mm-hmm. And so these are the kind of things where PRs actually help us, because internally the way that works is another team in another branch of the division will do some coding work, then they will send us the API diff, and we have not even an easy way to find out what the implementation is. Obviously, we can hook them in, we can ask them, and then some links can be sent around. The nice thing with GitHub is it's all in one place, right? So from our point of view, it's actually very easy to just quickly say, oh, how did he implement this particular method? Oh, yeah, he throws the wrong exception, and we just add it to the notes.
But we also do have, I think your question was more about, you know, once the API has been proposed, where does it go from there?
Yeah.
And we do have this concept of accepting PRs, which is once someone from the community can propose something, write it down, and, you know, we iterate on it and say, yep, we think this is great, let's do this. And then we can just mark that thing as accepting PRs, and then either the person who submitted the original request or, you know, someone else in the community can pick it up and do the implementation.
But we also have different processes. Imoro, those great API review tools. Yes, we want to use them during API reviews.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we...
Are we putting them online soon?
Yeah, that's something. Thanks for throwing me under the bus. Like the problem is that if you have tools like this,
it's going to be a long day, right?
Yeah, it'll be a long day. Like, it's not that we don't want to, but as you can imagine, when you build internal tools, they have dependencies left and right on other people's team deliverables, and you actually have to sync up and say, is it okay if I publish that binary?
And then can we talk about those? Because I have questions about what those do, but
absolutely,
I'm not sure we don't.
Yeah. Yes. No, we should. I mean, like, it's on my list. Like, basically, the one thing that we did, which you can see here, actually, is at the minimum thing, we basically provided at least, we changed our tool so we can actually at least export the API div.
Okay.
So, like, basically, the way that it works internally, we have a tool which you can see in the video where we see the API differences, and then we can, similar to Verge, just add comments to individual APIs, and then I can just, at the end of the meeting, I just hit export, generate this markdown file, and put it in.
And so you can see Imo's comments here at the just under capture collection there. The green is the new additions, and the red is the changes.
In many APIs, they evolve over time. So
API changes are usually additions.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
Then
if we saw
when
any
you
red
see
here,
the
it
whole,
would be an issue.
When you just see basically source code, it's sometimes difficult to tell like what existed before, mm-hmm. what is new.
Right.
So we have lots of tools and processes around the kind of evolution of APIs.
So like another good example would be like, do you have like a set of style cop rules that are now like, these are now our official rules? So like before you set how to make, like this is like the how to make your API submission the best it can be. Like this is style cop, code analysis, like what would you recommend people do before they submit stuff to
well,
you?
Well, definitely Christoph spoke, right?
Yeah. Before they submit.
Yes.
We need to codify that.
Yes. So we have FX cop. We have FX cop, which enforces a lot of the design guidelines. We'd definitely recommend that. A lot of the cases, you know, on our team at least, we kind of know the rules just by looking at them, so we don't really need to run them. But
because you guys wrote it, right? I mean, like.
So did we publish the digest?
We did publish.
We did publish it. The digest is on. We published the framework guideline digest on our wiki on CoreFX.
Which is like a.
The short version.
Short version of you know a 5 pages version of the book.
So you know, Christoph, while we have you here, like one of the things that we were talking about beforehand was the .NET Framework guidelines were like awesome. But they were kind of a snapshot in time, like 2006. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple things, like obviously linkifying APIs, async await, and dynamic, and how you design APIs, like when the right time to use one of those things. Are you all, and just to throw more work on you, are you all planning chapters that talk about best practices for those three things? And there's probably more that we could think about as well.
So I think that out of the three things that you mentioned, the async part, is the most kind of relevant to, you know, core APIs. And I think we did publish an update to the guidelines. It's not part of the book, because doing an edition of a book is just enormous effort. And I frankly hesitate to do it. Before this, maybe like a critical mass of, you know, there are multiple of these new editions that, besides async model. But I know that few years ago, I worked on guidelines with Mads, and I'm pretty sure that they were published. But
I think there was a Word doc circulating around.
We have them published internally. I don't know whether we published.
We should check it. If we didn't, we should do it. But basically, to answer your question, is I think that to update the book, there would need to be critical mass, and we don't have it yet. But we have some other means of distributing guidance like this. So we will make sure that we dig out the document and publish it if it's not already published.
Well, I think you'll find that our wiki online is probably going to be the future mm-hmm. of where we kind of iterate on these things. You know, we've got our break. I have them looking here. We can see there's our breaking change rules and a few other things there. So.
If there is an API and let's just say it's some long-running thing, maybe it's a network API, is the idea of it should absolutely have async as the model, But do you also see like a way that a customer would say do the old model of async as well, or where it doesn't have it's effectively a synchronous call that a customer is going to take care of? Like, when, and this goes back to maybe some of the breaking changes, but how would you tell somebody to design an async await API today?
Yeah, so definitely if there's something that is long running, something that people would like to execute on a, for example, UI thread, which async makes it relatively easy to kind of offload.
But we tend to avoid async in-memory operations,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So it in-memory, like the guidance, yeah, is just make the API synchronous and let the call out.
Yeah, if it's just basically...
What's an example of that?
If so it's like just computational, there's no like I/O sorting. Going on, then you know you can always make it into an async by just calling task.run, and then it just executes on a different thread. So yes, that's a good point. But in general, you know, the async support in C# makes it so easy to kind of compose APIs. I mean, code that is asynchronous and synchronous. So definitely, if there's something long running, especially if it has I/O, we do recommend doing async APIs.
Yeah, good recent example when you look at an API that is very, very async heavy. Is their new Roslyn APIs. So basically they have multiple layers. The bottom layer is the compiler. At the compiler level, basically almost everything except for literally reading the file is compute bound, right? I mean, once you have parsed the whole thing, like the parsing itself is compute bound, the binding steps are compute bound. But then when you actually look at it from an IDE perspective, when you look at I have my solution open, now I modify my solution, now like at every single interaction point, somewhere some IO could sneak in, right? And so if you look at the Roslyn APIs, what they call the higher level IDE layer is the workspace layer. Mm-hmm. And at the workspace layer, you have scenarios like, oh, you know, I have this concept of immutable solution, but the solution itself is always immutable just as the latest snapshot. And then there are some APIs that potentially trigger a compute bound operation, and they made them async so that they have an easier time chaining them together in Visual Studio. And so the editor itself, for example, is very snappy because it basically doesn't do anything on the foreground thread, even if it's compute bound.
And also, and definitely also, I remember when we were writing the guidance, it included kind of a section when not to use async. And for example, for very small granularity tasks, you don't want to use async. So you don't want to, for example, despite the fact that maybe a stream reader would cause ultimately an I/O operation because it wraps a stream and you want to read and parse, let's say, XML. Using some API. You don't want an async API to read every single element in an, you know, an XML document, because the overhead of async is just too high for some of the small granularity results.
Okay. And so thinking about some of this, so you're the API builder, and we talk about, for lack of a better word, the aesthetics of an API design. So like, what would you like? You know, you kind of went through some examples, like what would the exercise for the reader be like? Start with, and I remember some of these examples from the book, like start with how you would call the API, and maybe go through some of the process, like here, go through this and maybe use this as the way to review your own API before submission.
Yeah, I think like Christoph's Digest is probably the easiest starting point, because if you look at the whole thing, it's like, you know, maybe a couple of pages long, and it basically walks you through the key part, which, as Christoph pointed out, is scenario-driven design, right? You start with, what is the code that I want to write, essentially? And then you iterate on that, right? You have more fine-grained scenarios, and then you also think about what is already existing in the framework, how do these things map to each other, and then the other things are just, you know, you handle them as you go, right? But you have to start somewhere.
And have you all ever thought of putting, like, a wish list of areas that you wish the community would work on? So, like, for example, like say you're looking at Windows Update or some area that gives you all the list of .NET framework bugs, and you see the majority of bugs are coming from maybe it's this collection class or something, and it's like, ah, we don't have time for this. But like, hey folks, it would be great if somebody worked on this,
yeah,
and actually using data, or like, what are the areas that you guys are looking for volunteers, since we have a captive audience?
We've talked in the past of grabbing some of the bugs that we've got on Connect that we've kind of punted or said, you know, we don't really have time to look at that now, and just chucking them as on GitHub and marking them up for grabs. That there's like there's all sorts of things. Like one of the ones that we just came through was the inheriting handles on process. Right, it's a somewhat common thing that, well, it's a not common enough, but when you hit it, you want it. And someone just added a proposal to add the ability to inherit control whether handles are inherited by child processes. They're everywhere. Like if you use the framework on a day-to-day basis, there's so many areas that you just want to add an API here or an overload here, and I'm sure that.
Another thing I would love to see happen is if people kind of wrote more libraries on top of the core framework. The community has lots of good ideas. Many great libraries were created actually already by community. We started the work on portable libraries a few years ago. And my kind of the thing that I always wanted to get out of the portable libraries project is exactly to make it easy for community to create libraries and don't worry, oh, do I create the library for this platform, for .NET framework desktop, or for App Store apps, or for, so we kind of created the basis. I think it's now solid enough. And I would love many of the libraries that already exist in the community to be ported to the portable library project. And new libraries. People have lots of great ideas. I love innovation in the community. So that's what I would like. I would love to see happen.
And for some of these requests, like how does it actually get factored? Like this regex example, because you guys talked about like the way we distribute this is actually using NuGet. So is the idea of like a person's pull request, maybe you're changing just their new parts in regular expressions, or is it like, hey, this library already ships as NuGet, so it's really just an addition? Or how do you start thinking about how to factor these pull requests into their own NuGets?
Do you want to talk about the
framework? Yeah, so there's kind of two things that we have to think about. One is there's the new .NET Core stack, which is a self-contained kind of BCL that spans server and client in the app stores. And then there's the .NET framework, which is what we call internally. Internally, we call it desktop. And they're kind of two separate stacks. So in the .NET Core stack, everything is a NuGet is a self-contained binary that lives in a NuGet package. So when Justin's pull request gets accepted and merged into the repo, the next time we release an update for regular expressions, it will just be included as part of that. Then the next step from there is deciding what and when things get rolled back to the full framework. So the interfaces in this case, we would likely roll them back into the desktop just in the next update of the desktop. But there might be some things on the side that we don't add to the desktop, but instead just ship it as a separate component that works both on desktop and .NET Core. Some examples of that are Immutable. We never put Immutable into the box. It's just a self-contained library that runs across all of our stacks. Unlike the rest of the full framework, it just comes with your app. So
as we're creating some of these new libraries, we do have we call them contracts. As we bring them online, we have to decide if it's important to have type equivalents with the existing types in desktop. And if it is, then they become facades on desktop. Dave and Imo, I'm talking their expertise here, but in those cases, it does become a lot harder to get it, or there's a longer lag to get it into desktop, because we want type equivalence with the desktop types. The types exist there, so that's when that path happens. For some of our new libraries, where it's totally on top, like Immutable, like Metadata, and others, if we can do it entirely on top, and there's no type equivalence problems with desktop, then we'll ship it as a NuGet in both places. And in that case, we can.
But it's a trade-off, right? Yeah. A good example is we just added array.empty, which is basically a method that returns an empty array, very similar to the numerable.empty. It just doesn't allocate. Once you've created the first array, you don't need to allocate after that. In that case, that it's not possible to do something like that on top of .NET, on top of the full .NET framework, without creating a separate type and kind of bolting it on the side. So in this case, we would port that back to desktop.
Sure.
And you know, add it to the array type itself. But it is a trade-off, and we're still it's a learning process. We're still going through it, and we're trying to figure out, you know, when we add on top versus when we pull it back into the box.
And think about like the all up process. You know, you make these changes, and especially for some that are coming from the community, how do you do things like security and threat modeling for that? And then I think the other one was some of the new APIs and the way the ASP.NET team is thinking about things like strong naming, where they're trying to get away from certain things. And how do you manage something that works great on desktop while ASP.NET is maybe going in a different direction? And you know, we're all trying to be one big happy family. So I'll just throw out that bomb and let you go.
Yeah, I think I'm under the truck the whole time. No, the I think in general, like the high level goal is like if you look back and when the framework shipped originally, there were a certain set of priorities that were part of the framework. And sandboxing was a clear requirement for the framework originally. It might be adequate access security. Then later on, we added security transparency. And then in Silverlight, they had a whole elaborate story on that. And so like once you design these systems, like the question is. At some point, if the feature doesn't have enough usage, the question is, does it hurt to maintain the feature, or is it something where it gets actively in the way, right? And strong naming, as we have done it in the past, like sandboxing, and some of these things are actually actively trying to, like makes it super hard for us to evolve the feature, right? Mm-hmm. Like a good example is every time we do something with strings, for example, whether it's like having a better string builder or having a, you know, some sort of object pooling behind the scenes, there are massive security implications because strings are super sensitive potentially, right? They could have paths in them that are used by the security subsystem to validate that you have access to those paths. So leaking those strings or just making them, you know, writable via reflection, for example, would be a massive security hole. But from our point of view, like framework still has these things because it is shipped, the features are supported. For .NET Core in particular, like we explicitly said, we assume that everybody who's using .NET Core will run full trust. So there is no sandboxing on .NET Core. In fact, like you know, we don't care for those scenarios anymore because we say, well, there are some issues that we have with reflection, for example, where people you know use reflection to actually access privates. On desktop, that's possible today if you're running in full trust. But ignoring full trust, it has implications for us to evolve desktop, for example. Like we had to bake out changes because somebody depended on the order of which private fields are returned or the name of the private fields and stuff like that, right? So we still care about things like reliability on our side, but with .NET Core, some of these things are basically solving themselves, right? Because if you ship the framework out of band and the app author has to opt into a newer version, and that new version breaks you because you happen to depend on something that you should not have depended on, our answer would be, well, fix your code at that point, right? Versus on .NET framework, we can't do that because like you test your app, you ship your app on a version of the framework, and then Windows Service kicks in from behind the scenes and changes the framework on which you're running, and now your app is broken, and you weren't even in the picture, right? And so some of these things are just trade-offs in the sense that, okay, what are our priorities now? What are the things we care about? And then basically, what are the things that we have to look out for? But we'd be, like, one of the key things that we want to maintain is our agility to ship stuff more frequently, get feedback earlier and often. And if features are in the way of doing that, then we probably have to either find a way to no longer support this feature or, like, basically do it slightly differently, right? Sometimes you have multiple ways of doing things, and the way we did it in the past might not be the best way moving forward. A good example here would be strong.
And for that answer for code access security, it sounds like everything's full trust going forward for .NET Core. So if you depended on that feature, don't use .NET Core or upgrade your code. Is effective.
There's not a lot of people depending on code access security. Yeah. It's usually getting in the way.
The dozens of Microsoft employees that worked on code access security are probably the ones that actually did it. So.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a good example.
Well, even they tell you not to use it. Look at, I mean, ASP.NET dropped it as a trust boundary, and there's a, you know, we still have to maintain this for certain parts of desktop, and that's part of the reason why it makes it hard to bring some of these features or costly to bring some of these features back to desktop. But in .NET Core, we're trying to have a chance to reestablish where, you know, the right effort between like or the right balance between effort and useful functionality.
Having said that, as Emil said, information disclosure is something that we would still probably try to catch doing code reviews. More code reviews than API reviews. Even in the past, when we did have code access security, security reviews were mainly about the implementation and less so about APIs. Not that it's impossible to design an API that is not optimal from security perspective, but it's more common to have a problem in the implementation than in APIs.
Yeah, and the actual review process, like when it's actually going to be burned into code, you all would have somebody that does security and threat models. That things you all are looking to publish, so like a customer could potentially even model their own or have the first draft of for you?
Yeah, so I think as far as threat modeling goes, I mean, most of the stuff was driven from the sandboxing perspective, right? And so I think for .NET Core, we probably don't do threat modeling anytime soon anymore.
Oh, apart from networking.
Apart from networking, like things that are super low level and are problematic. But like
some of
the
regex assemblies is like one example where it's like if somebody does that badly, and I don't know how many people are doing assembly load from pull requests, but that would be a.
Yep. I mean, there's other technologies right now that try to do sandboxing more at the OS layer, right? You either have like process isolation or you have things like, you know, Docker or other scenarios where you basically just try to contain the thing more from an operating system standpoint, less from the managed code standpoint. And like especially with managed code, it is super hard to actually contain something, right? Because I mean, sandboxing, when you have an object-oriented API, is super hard because there's so many scenarios you can use an API, you can derive from something, you can override a method, and that fundamentally changes the behavior versus a Win32, where if you have a flat API list, where you basically have pure data coming in and out, not that it's trivial to do there, but you have a higher chance of actually keeping a system closed because the interaction points are a bit more controlled than there are in object-oriented frameworks. But yeah, I mean, it's as I said, like it's all a trade-off like we're learning right now. So I don't know if we ever put .NET Core in something that is super security sensitive, probably we have to revamp some of the work again, yeah, right?
And I think if we had an API review that had an obvious trust boundary in it, we would have to revisit some of this discussion. It hasn't happened yet. We're talking about regex. It doesn't touch the file system, doesn't touch the network directly. So, but if we started looking at community contributions for things like a networking library, we'd certainly have to like see what part of the threat modeling makes sense to apply to that, because we still care about .NET Core from a we still want to provide a lot of the same guarantees around the quality level of the code for people consuming it as we do for the desktop. So it's not a free for all. we'll apply the right process when it's.
And we talked about some of the things where, like, if somebody wanted to make a pull request for something kind of deep into the framework versus, because it's almost easier to do the when you're higher up on a stack. And I'm adding a new set of collections that are just optimized. Maybe it's math libraries, or you could imagine a vertical, if you will, that isn't going to touch a lot of the framework. But now somebody's talking about potentially like affecting something like string that affects everyone. How do you all think about that, where it's a much deeper interaction level? Because a lot of times that's really you have to talk to people that are dependent on you and breaking changes and everything else.
I would say, like, as many things when they're complex, it's incrementally, right? I mean, the first thing is if you talk to the team owning the core things like string and others, like usually when you suggest changing something, they immediately say, "Hold on!" Like, I mean, there's not like, "Oh, let's just party on this thing." So there's already like like a barrier of entry, right? You have to convince some core people to say, "Is it even worth it?" Right? And in many cases, even if you touch the string class, you can do something like, "Oh, it's a method that just literally just wraps another method," so it's relatively easy to do that. Good example is like we missed some overloads that took string comparison, for example, right? I mean, these are very easy things. Now, the only problem is, of course, you don't have to touch desktop and actually add an overload or something, but it is something you can relatively easy reason about, right? Versus, let's say we want to change the layout of string, right? That would be a super impactful change because there's many assumptions in the system, like the interrupt layer and other components that rely on predicting what that layout is, right? And and so like some of this is just experience. You kind of know where the problems are, but the other part of it is even at some point if you say, okay, it's absolutely worth it, and I think Christoph can talk about span of T in that context maybe, then you basically have to do it incrementally, right? Then you basically, you know, you start with rolling it out in some area, and you learn as you go, right? And then if the thing seems to be worth it, and then you just take it in the other areas. And a good example in the past would be async, right? I mean, async is a somewhat impactful change because you have to touch pretty much the entire vertical.
I'd say impactful. Right? You don't have to add somewhat.
But definitely, I would say that as you go lower on the kind of dependency stack in framework APIs, we need to be more and more conservative about how we evolve it. And it has nothing to do whether it's community contributions. We internally are very conservative how we evolve APIs at the bottom of the stack. And the reason for it is that higher level libraries they have the lifespan of, let's say, you know, 5, maybe 10 years. After a while, you know, people have better way to do, I don't know, dependency injection or a better UI stack. But something like string or object, we literally will not be able to replace it, and we don't have any plans to replace it. We cannot replace string and say, hey, you know, for we were not very conservative and we kind of butchered the string that we used to have and now we need to have a new one. That is something that we just could not do. Therefore, we are very conservative and we the bar for additions, API additions in this layer is very, very high.
Yeah, you can only change string every year in C++. That's a different story. You mentioned dependency injection and thinking about probably testability. That's another area. Like, are you all giving guidelines like, hey, how to do this? Because you see the ASP.NET team, for example, start talking about DI as part of a core framework. Like, this is no longer use your favorite third-party tool. This is something we're going to support. And obviously, they make it so that you can use your third-party tool. How do you all think about that for the core framework?
David, I think you wrote a couple of
I've written a few.
Some code about this.
So, I think as you go, I mean, as you go lower, it's less about making things DI friendly. It's I think the it's more about how do you make the right extension points for people to plug in, rather than actually making everything an interface. Like there is a reason why we don't make everything an interface, because it's hard to version them, and it's easier to also the barrier to entry for IOC is quite high, and ASP.NET have made that easier by baking it in, but it's still a high barrier to entry. And just look at the file APIs. I mean, you're looking at some of the abstraction layer at the moment and your file APIs. And
and the barrier meaning like the concept count or for a customer to do it, like how many customers would actually do it, like, is that what you mean
barrier? You have to change the way you think with IOC. And it's not a easy API to approach, you know. Just like file is an awesome example of this. Like, we have a bunch of static methods on file, and turns out they're very easy to use, right?
Yeah.
Easier once we added the additional overloads in V2, but.
Yeah, they're extremely easy to use, and they're extremely dangerous to provide control to redefine their behavior. So we looked at eliminating them, and there was just too much usage. And so they remain in the file system contract in the core implementation. We looked at exposing an extension point at that level, and the implications of that, the fact that one library might be able to control the file resolution behavior of an entire application, were too dangerous for us to say, like, we're all in, let's do this. So we figure if someone needs that, then they're probably the app developer, or they own the API. We think that the right trade-off there is to, you know, build the abstraction at your level. We can't for these. There are places in the framework where there's a line that we can't. Putting in the extension point to make it more DI friendly is a greater risk to the rest of the framework and to people's expectations around behavior of that API in the framework than the benefit you get from testability. And we think that the right thing to do at those cases is to build the abstraction higher. Yeah.
So it seems like software engineers have been doing, you mentioned strings, but you know, we've been doing strings for years. String is very mature, correct? Same with something like stream. Stream
sure.
abstractions are very mature, and you know, software engineers know how to design them. There is, you know, variation, there are slightly different streams, but we kind of know. I still feel that for DI frameworks, we kind of don't know, you know, what is the design. So because of that, I feel like DI frameworks are better left to be libraries, where you can have multiple alternatives competing with each other, and then customers just choosing the best one.
Okay.
You know, the best one wins. versus us putting something in the core and baking it into the core kind of promotes would have to promote one of those DI frameworks, and we don't think that the DI framework architecture or the design is mature enough to do this.
It kind of adds a level of rigidity too. Like if you now like, oh, I just want to do this, but now to do this file, I have to actually have an interface of an interface and repository.
Not
and
just
all of a sudden
that.
It feels like Java.
Not just like it basically you're making everything virtual, and there's a reason we don't make everything virtual, because every single implementation change that we make could result in a breaking change to something upstack, right? So. Like you just change the order. You read this property before this property, and now you have to start thinking about that as you make the code changes. So there's a reason we plug in extension points. We make extension points very deliberate at the right level, and so that we don't have to think about that at every single change that we're making.
And also at the very lowest level,
performance starts.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about performance, because you guys have a huge performance lab and compatibility lab, like. You know, whether, let's just say I'm adding some crazy, collection classes for maybe it's math or we've added some newer collection classes as well for high performance. Like, what are the things that you would expect from an API spec to do that? And then how do you actually test the performance in real world where it works great on one, but maybe not at scale, for example?
I think it's a topic in itself.
I need a 2-minute answer for how you build performant framework.
Measure.
Yeah.
I think somebody said measure. I think that performance is something that sometimes intuition, even of very seasoned engineers, is wrong. So there's no substitute for measuring. Lots of experience as well helps. Mm-hmm.
I think another interesting thing that we just talked about this like a few days ago about performance. The other thing with performance is, like as far as design goes, what you can get with an API design is you can avoid really stupid mistakes, right? Like things where, you take, objects that are allocated on the heap and you basically have to provide them every single time you call them just by the shape of the APIs, right? That's something that's very easily like something you can see and then say, maybe we shouldn't do that. Or you have things like, this really should be a struct, but it turns out to be a class that has other problems. Or we made this interface, but now because of the API shape, it's never generic, so you always make interface dispatch. So some of those things you can kind of see in API reviews. But the problem is once you build a larger system, and a good example would be Roslyn, like the entire Roslyn system is basically based on a very core principle, which is everything is immutable. So every change you do, you have to allocate somewhere. So the question is, how do you make the allocations really fast? So that you don't have to diff large trees all the time. The second question is how do you avoid allocating garbage? Because then as you allocate more garbage, the GC has to do more work. And that is something that is not something you can pinpoint a single point in the code. Like once you have a larger system, it's all over the place, right? It's a tiny bit here, tiny bit there, a tiny bit there. And these tiny bits are something you don't see, right? But as you measure them, they accumulate to something very measurable, right? And then in case of Rust, in a very core scenario is IntelliSense. So you can measure how quickly does it take me to pop up the IntelliSense window populated with items. And then how quickly can I refactor? Like these are the high level things where all these small trade-offs become really, really, really apparent. But if you look at them in isolation, they don't probably show up on anybody's radar. Cool. And that's, I think, part of the problem. And security, I think, is literally the same, right? It's you can avoid stupid mistakes, but once you throw in a larger system together, you can still have massive holes.
Yeah. I'll add one piece here, but given the experience in Compat and given the experience in servicing for desktop. Most of the times when you can predict, when you can write a test case to predict one of these changes, you can do that for anything, right? Almost any change, you can write code and observe that change, and you can say, is that a compatibility issue? I don't know. Almost any change you make, you can find the worst case performance scenario, you can write a test case to execute that. At the end of the day, the thing that actually determines whether or not it's important is whether or not somebody's actually doing that. And the only way you get that is real-world testing, large labs, like getting it out there, getting people to run through their specific scenario, measuring it, and telling you what the problems are. So, there's this law of diminishing returns or that type of model with lab test passes where you're trying to get as much in there as what matters to you, what are your high priority scenarios, and then the rest you have to rely on the larger community to help you find.
Cool. Awesome. Well, folks, maybe we should. This is great. We should probably have another one and go through and deep dive. We can do performances. Probably another one. And actually, how just the whole labs and how you all set up and minimum requirements stuff. But just for interest of time, so recommended resources for folks who want to get their pull request in. You mentioned this wiki and the.
So definitely our wiki. I mean, the we've got a before you contribute. Or how can you contribute? Wiki page that kind of covers some of the things that, you know, we don't want to be surprised by massive pull requests that completely changes everything. You know, we want to iterate over things and make sure that you've kind of got buy-off from the team. Just like any open source project, you know, you kind of want to file an issue first for big things and get the approval. But definitely our wiki is one site to watch. Christoph's book, I mean, is definitely still the best resource for API design.
And we should follow up on that async await stuff if that's public or not.
Yes,
we should. So throw Christoph under the bus, you maybe should pack out of the books also available in some wiki that we can actually link to.
Book in a wiki?
Well, the actual content.
I thought it was in MSDN somewhere.
Yeah.
I remember.
We've got that on our wiki now.
And besides, I thought the definition of a wiki is people write the content, not you copy and paste from a
book. Well, maybe wiki is the wrong term. I'm just saying, like, available online so we can link to it.
I see.
And I think what we have on MSDN is just a tiny subset. It's not all of it. And some other, like, you had, like, some, I mean, the other thing with the book is, like, there's the actual rule part, and then there's, like, about 20 or 30 pages in the book that just deal with general design, and they can totally be something that people should read either way, independent of the actual rules, because they're a timeless advice. I think another resource that people always overlook with open source project is just the pull request discussions themselves. So as I mentioned in some of our blog posts, is that we no longer have code reviews internally for stuff that is on GitHub. Like what you see on GitHub in terms of PRs is obviously external people trying to get stuff in, but it's also our folks that actually review their own changes.
Right.
So by just reading what's going on, you get a sense of what feedback do we give our own team versus what do we give external people, and really that should be the same. And then you can just learn from that as well. Like it's not just the actual rule, it's also the doing.
I'm glad you guys put so much faith in the book, but I would say, you know, second what Imo said, like just do APIs, put them up for, you know, either to the community. If community says the APIs are great, there's likelihood that we will say that they are great. Propose a PR, we will review it, we will discuss it publicly online. A lot of the API design skills that we built here internally were not by people reading a 350 pages book. The skills were built by people trying to build APIs and us basically meeting in a room and trying to discussing the pros and cons, and we all learn by doing so.
Okay, so learn by doing is definitely the takeaway. Great. Awesome, guys. So really appreciate it. And for folks who maybe don't know the GitHub address, because I know you hit it real quick.
Yes.
You want to just quickly.
And this resolution, it's a bit tricky, but basically.
.net core effects, GitHub.
Yes.
So GitHub.com/core effects.
Yep.
Okay.
We can link it under the show too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.